The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
I'm a big believer that one of the misconceptions is that conflict is seen as a way of damaging relationships, when if I think about the people in my life who I have the most conflict with, they're the people who I have the strongest relationships with. I actually think it's a source of connection, not necessarily a source of disconnection.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Amy Gallo. Amy's been doing some really cool work around the world with her book as the author of Getting Along. She's also a contributing editor at the Harvard Business Review. And we were just talking pre-show about how the world needs more conflict, not less, in teams. So I think that's going to be a really cool theme to be diving into amongst all the other cool things that Amy does in workplace dynamics. So welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you so much, Dane. This is going to be fun.
Super fun. Tell us a little bit more about how you came to be doing all of this cool writing and work and, you know, at the edges that you're at.
Yeah. So I started my interest in interpersonal dynamics probably from the moment I could watch people interact. I've always been a keen observer, and I've always been fascinated with when people say one thing, but they actually mean another. So we're saying one thing, but the truth is very different. And that sort of juxtaposition of what's said and what's meant is, I think, interpersonally, like in my personal life, has always been very interesting to me, but professionally really came sort of into sharp focus when I worked as a management consultant, a job I did not like. I didn't like it, not because it wasn't, I didn't believe in it, or because the work wasn't interesting. It was just that there was so much of that disconnect between what was said and what was the truth that I kept sitting in these meetings with clients and be like, what if we actually just said what we all meant? Like, what if we just like, and so when I was at that firm, I was lucky enough that a few of the partners of that firm had been writing articles for Harvard Business Review. And I'd helped out with a few of those articles with research or with some writing, and started then transitioned that, knowing I wanted to leave consulting, transitioned that into writing directly for HBR. And so that's when I started writing articles and eventually wrote my first book, The HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict. And then my second book was also with HBR called Getting Along. And it's just sort of this lifelong interest in human dynamics, but also really focused in now on the workplace. Not because that's the most important place, but I think it's a place where we spend so much time, and there's a larger disconnect between what we think we're allowed to do, our emotions. Like, in our personal life, when something's hard, we're like, of course it's hard. I'm invested in this relationship. I care about this person. Like, when something gets hard at work, we just go, it's not personal. Why, you know, like we tell people not to take it as seriously. And I think that's just a big mistake.
I think that's great. It's funny what we've been taught to say and to perform in workplaces, and how far away that is from the truth of like human reality and being.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like we expect people to like check ego and emotions at the door. And yet emotions, of course, are with us all the time.
Yeah.
And you could try to suppress them. That just makes them feel worse and makes everyone else feel worse. Like, there's really interesting studies that show when you suppress your emotions, like especially negative ones, right? Anger, disappointment, fear, your blood pressure goes up. You have all these physical signs. But there's research that also shows the people you are with when you are suppressing your emotions have the same physical reaction, right? Like,
really?
It's not good for, yes, right? Like, it's not good for a team for you to be suppressing those emotions. But we also tell people to like suppress ego, like inadvertently or directly we tell them to suppress ego. And I don't know anyone who doesn't go to work to not find ego, right? Like,
yeah.
To not find ego satisfaction. It's like, I mean, we're all looking to feel like we belong, we matter, we're smart. And of course we do that at work. So this idea that we should just oh, I have no feelings. I have nothing invested here. It's all good. Right? It's just, I think it's just silly.
It's super silly. I'm glad that you've created that lens, that frame, because I've been having a lot of conversation with guests and with friends in life lately around emotions. And it's interesting, this whole concept of suppressing emotions, because I think as leaders that have lived through 20, 30, 40 years of this is how you show up in the workplace, and then COVID happens, and then a whole lot starts changing, which probably triggered some of those people who were carrying all of that weight, I'm certainly one of them, into some different behaviors, different moments of realization. And now you just see, I think, this general state of like exhaustion, fatigue, culture shifting. I mean, there's just a lot going on for teams right now. And with every leader we ever sit with, one of the first conversations is kind of more one of like emotional regulation first, because you kind of need to go there before you tackle the rest of the problems that are in front of you.
Yeah. Oh, you brought up my like favorite phrase at the moment, which is emotional regulation, because I think so much of what is wrong with teams and wrong with work right now would benefit from emotional regulation. So that's music to my ears. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more from your work, whether it was the early guide, or, you know, the more recent book, Getting Along. Where did that research, where did the writing, where did it take you into some real sparks and highlights of, hey, these are things more leaders, more teams need to be grabbing a hold of with two hands?
Yeah. Both books, actually, I started in one place with sort of where I was thinking about the idea, and then ended up in a very different place after writing them. And get the HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict, I went in thinking, oh, I'm going to help people deal with the worst part of work, right? Which is conflicts, which disagreements. I'm going to help people have these like amazing connected interactions where they feel, safe and fulfilled. And I did write the book with that intention. And yet when I finished it, what I realized is that everyone who was asking me to come speak about the book or do workshops or just do an interview like this, what they really were asking was, how do we have better conflict, not less? Mm-hmm. And what you would think, as someone who thinks and talks about this all the time, I would be invited into organizations that are rife with disagreement, and, you know, there's just like all out brawls and people can't get along and there's too much gossip. And it's 99% of the time the exact opposite, which is our employee surveys say people don't feel comfortable speaking up. Our leaders tell us that there's silence in meetings, that cameras are off if they're remote, right? That people are just not contributing. And what they're hearing from people, and you may see this in your own work, is like, mm-hmm. they're hearing from people like, it's just not safe. Like, I have ideas, but I don't believe that my manager wants to hear them. I don't believe leadership is interested in them. I don't believe if I say something, take a risk and say something, because obviously speaking up is always a risk. I don't believe if I say something, anything will change. And so that really changed my mindset of like, oh no. And we actually need more conflict at work, not less. And we need more productive conflict. We need to equip people with the ability to speak up. We need to equip managers with how to handle that when that happens. But we also need to sort of put guardrails around it and help people understand this is not debate team. You know, this is not the version of conflict and disagreement we see portrayed on reality TV or US politics, right? This is a version of conflict in which we're together trying to make a decision, to reach a goal, to surface assumptions, to bond, right? Because I'm a big believer that one of the misconceptions is that conflict is seen as a way of damaging relationships, when if I think about the people in my life who I have the most conflict with, they're the people who I have the strongest relationships with.
Absolutely.
And so, So it's like, I actually think it's a source of connection, not necessarily a source of disconnection.
Oh, I really like that. We had Michael McCarroll come on the show from Team Radri, and he talked about the epiphany effect of where if people come through a hard moment together, they build a stronger bond. But I would imagine that coming through a hard moment requires you to have more productive conflict because it's time bound and it's pressured.
Yeah. Well, and it's that hard moment is going to generate conflict, right? You're going to have to, you're not going to see it the exact same way. You're not going to experience it the exact same way. To get from point A to point B, to get through the muck, you're going to have to talk about different ways you could do that. Who's in charge, right? What process should we use? What's our ultimate goal? All of that. I mean, there, once you sort of start thinking, and this was a big shift for me too when I wrote the guide, was that I just saw moments of conflict constantly, right? Yeah. And I think we think of conflict as these big moments where things are tense. I'm like, it's always. Because what if conflict at its basic is like just a disagreement or even just sort of a competing idea, intention, agenda, interest. And those, whether we speak them out loud, whether we sort of get into the tug of war about it or not, those are happening all day long. It's happening when I go to the coffee shop. It's happening when I deal with the handyman who comes to my house. It's happening when we're trying to set up this, you know, equipment and technology to figure out how to record this conversation. Right? Like it's just happening all the time, and it's always an opportunity. For me, I see it as an opportunity for connection.
I love this. So big question. When you go into an organization and it's that stereotypical, very friendly, very nice veneer of like, hey, we're productive, we're getting work done, and you don't see the conflict, where are the places to go looking for it? Who do you start with to say, let's find where it is and find a way into the conversation?
Let me step back because whenever I start working with someone, it can be a team in Minneapolis, it can be a team in Sao Paulo. Whenever I start working with a team, they're like, you should know something about our culture. We're incredibly polite. And they always have a reason. It's like, oh, it's because we're in the Midwest, or it's because, our 100-year legacy as a pharmaceutical company. Like, they always have some reason that they believe they are uniquely and overly polite and nice. Yeah. And what I really try to help them understand is like, no, that's human nature, right? Like, it feels good when things are smooth. It feels good when we have a sense of harmony, even if it's not true harmony. We have survived in groups as humans by getting along, by having things go smoothly.
Yeah.
And so it's every culture has that sort of, you know, and they always, sometimes it's a nickname. I don't want to out any of my clients, but like, let's just say the company name is Gallo, right? Which is my last name. They would say like, oh, we have Gallo Nice. You know, like they're always they think it's so unique to their culture, which is, you know, good for them. I want them to think that because then they can solve the problem in their cultural context. The place I often go is I start with, it depends if I'm working with a senior leadership team or they want me to do something for a broader group. I always ask, well, what are the conflicts that do happen, right? What comes up, what gets said, what doesn't get said? And then I'll ask, what are the conflicts you think need to come up that don't, right? What are the conversations people aren't having? And inevitably there'll be, and this is actually why I wrote the second book, inevitably they'll always point to someone. They're like, well, so-and-so has a ton of conflict, and you know, they'll either because they're passive aggressive or they're a pessimist or they're overly political. And so they often hang it on a personality trait. And oftentimes I'm trying to help them understand like, oh, but maybe that person is actually raising the things that need to be said, but maybe not just doing it in the right way, or maybe it's just so countercultural. And so I always try to sort of look for those sort of grains of sand that are really sticking in people's shoes, which is often a person of like, who's irritating people and why, and what are they doing that actually maybe needs to be replicated and by other people, which is really uncomfortable because they're like, you're pointing out the one problematic person. You're telling us we should be more like them. I was like, well, I'm not saying you have to be more like them, but let's figure out what they're doing that's causing friction, because friction, when sort of channeled in the right way, is incredibly helpful to an organization, right? It's where we get innovation. It's where we get that connection. It's where we help get greater understanding, self-understanding, team understanding. Yeah. That friction is not something we want to eliminate. It's actually something we want to dial up.
I like that, dial it up. I love that earlier soundbite you touched on too, which is like conflict is always there. And so it's like, if you're not seeing it, then you need to raise it, because the friction might be showing up in a non-productive way rather than in a productive way.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and I'm curious, because you work with lots of teams, like what do you have the sort of same experience of it's this sort of politeness and niceness is the prevailing culture?
I think it's one of them. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think there's other teams that I've worked with, particularly more scientific engineering minded teams, where I wouldn't say it's like a domineering or a bullying culture, but it's very like top down. So they're not necessarily polite, but they still don't make room for productive conflict. So that's kind of another variation that I see quite often, particularly, you know, I've spent a lot of my life putting people to work on large oil and gas and mining sites where construction is very, you know, go over there, get that done, do it safely. It's very directive.
Yeah. Well, in that sort of command and control, you wouldn't have much conflict there, right? But you're also not hearing, you don't have conflict till something goes really wrong, right? Yeah. And otherwise it's just do what I say, do it in this way, right? There's protocol, there's hierarchy. That feels very, and some people love those environments. It works really well for them, but it's typically not an innovative environment.
No. And we see those, particularly in those project environments, we see them run long on schedule, have quality issues, have budget issues, because the productive conflict isn't coming up day to day. There's a great example. This is a perfect example of where conflict didn't show up soon enough. Large project. They were finishing construction and moving into the commissioning cycle, which is a very tight period because you're trying to turn everything on and electrify it, make sure it works, and you're getting towards the end of the project. And all of a sudden, there's a fist fight between two very senior managers on site. Massive fist fight, like police assault. And when you actually peel back what had happened, for months in this project, both of these leaders had realized that things were going wrong. They hadn't come together and talked about the conflict. One of them was definitely acting with low integrity. And they were, sending some of their teams off to do other projects when they should have been on this project, which isn't uncommon. But the tension hadn't come out. The friction hadn't been pushed towards how do we make this work for our shared objective. And then when the pressure really hit, it's a fist fight. And it's just like, that shouldn't be happening. These are educated adults, working with very expensive and dangerous equipment with a whole bunch of people they're responsible for. And that just happened.
Yeah. Well, it's such a visual example of what happened, because most often what I see is it just like it's simmering under the surface. There's not actually a fist fight, but there's same damage. In some ways, fist fight would actually be nice, because then it's like, oh, okay, now we know what's going on.
Right? Yeah.
But it's more often just this sort of quiet simmering. But the story also makes me think of that concept of emotional regulation, because it's not only the suppressed conflict, the lack of conversation, but obviously those two folks did not have the emotional regulation skills to step back and be like, I feel like I want to punch you right now. But instead, I'm going to do this, right? They had, that seemed a logical next step for them, which is, I think most people are like, I've never witnessed a fist fight in my workplace. Please tell me that doesn't really happen, but it does.
Sadly, it does. So that's two kind of variants, the overly polite and then the overly command and control. Are there other variations of workplace dynamics, workplace cultures where you see people kind of steer away from the productive conflict?
There is this culture, and it's not super common. I actually don't get asked to work with these teams or these organizations that often, but I hear about them because I have individuals reach out to me, which is that it's sort of like the Ray Dalio approach of the just incredibly direct, honest feedback all the time.
Yeah.
But it's not, what I hear is in its worst form, it's just an excuse to be a jerk. And, you know, this like, oh, just say what's on your mind, but it's really just saying the worst things on your mind. And I think those cultures need very clear guardrails and very clear guidelines. And without them, you're going to get these places where people, and in fact, someone I worked with went to work for Ray Dalio's organization, and I was like, oh, he's perfect for that. He's got tough, you know, thick skin. I think it was like 6 months, he's like, I'm out of here. And it wasn't, he said, I respect what they're doing. I just didn't enjoy being part of it. And so I think that's another sort of type of culture, which is like it's the incredibly direct, but I would call it brutal culture. And I see that a lot, like finance, I think is a big industry. Legal can sometimes be that, although I work with a lot of law firms where the lawyers are very good at being very direct and honest with clients, but they cannot be direct and honest with each other. So it feels brutal because everyone is a litigator at heart, but it doesn't have that vibe inside the organization.
Fascinating. I've seen the same with some British recruiting and sales cultures. There's a real like banter culture in the UK, but then that can just tip over into we're just going to start taking each other out of the knees.
right. There's a like that, right? With there's sort of jabs, they love to sort of tease, and then it's like, oh wow, that was a harsh jab, right?
Yeah.
I've seen that too.
Although, fascinatingly, I was just talking to one of my old bosses the other day. I was like, some of the best bosses we've worked for, we've generally disliked because they brought so much conflict and just raw emotion. However, they got the best results. So what's going on there?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I think I would like to say that those are the exception. And because a lot of times I talk a lot about humble leadership, right? Compassionate. I talk about prioritizing people's feelings, like, and they're like, oh, but they love to point to Elon Musk or Steve Jobs. They're like, I'm like, yeah, but those are the exception. Like, that's not how none of the research shows that those are effective styles of leadership. Mm-hmm. They just got lucky, honestly, in some ways. So I think that we think that this sort of directness and honesty in a harsh way or in a very directive way is a shortcut. And it might feel like, oh, I get results in the short term, but I think in the long term, you build a culture that's founded on distrust. And so you're not going to, it may work in certain environments and certain teams, but ultimately the entire organization is going to suffer because on the teams where you don't have a group that's comfortable with that, and in a team where perhaps you have a lot of diversity, for example, so there's a lot more to navigate in terms of difference and how people show up. Like, I think there's just a so much more going on that I do believe that those types of leadership that are either about jabs or being too overly direct are just not that effective in the long run.
This is interesting. You talk about it's not sustainable. I don't think it's just not sustainable to the company. I don't think it's sustainable to the families and the communities that the employees go home to. And that's a big reason we've been excited about exploring the healthy team as a concept, as opposed to the high-performing team. Because I've seen plenty of high-performing teams that are just running on the stress response. And they get results quarter over quarter. But people burn out, and when you actually pause and look back over 3 or 5 years, you realize that we delivered for shareholders, but not all of our stakeholders, not necessarily for our customers, not for our employees, not for their families. And I know that, you know, in the world that we've just been living through recently, there's been this whole pushback around like woke sentiment, but surely that's a big part of what leaders need to be doing in their teams is thinking about like, talk about balanced scorecard, but on a human level, like how are we actually sending people home? How are we sending people on to their next jobs, onto their next projects or volunteering assignments, because you've got to think in the world that we're living with now, particularly with AI, this whole loneliness epidemic, that that's going to start showing up, maybe not on the balance sheet, but it's going to start showing up around companies, brands, cultures.
Yeah. Well, and there's been talk about burnout for decades, right? But I think it's just reaching a real intensity. So many people feel, and even people who love their jobs, who think they work in a wonderful culture or feel like they, feel like they're doing good work in the world, they find meaning in it, all of that, that they still are burning out. And that burnout is, as you said, has repercussions for the family they go home to, for the neighborhood that they're part of, for the community groups they're part of. Yep. Right? It is incredibly hard to have that emotional regulation when you are burnt down. And that burnout might be, you know, I'm working 18 hours. So that burnout might be, I am frustrated about the systems that in my organization. It might even be, I don't know how long I'll have this job because we're starting all these AI initiatives. Right? There's so many levels of burnout that are happening.
It's interestingly, because in Australia now, probably in some European countries too, there's now legislation coming out around psychosocial safety. And they're now starting to put onus on companies to prove that they don't have toxic workplaces. And we had Mita Madak on the show recently, and she was talking about how in her research and writing, a person's boss has the single biggest impact on their mental health right now. So I can see where some of those shifts are coming from.
Yeah. And I think some, you know, my daughter's doing a shift job for the summer. You know, she's her first year home after college, and she doesn't know her schedule, right? Like, and it's so interesting to watch that. Like, she can't predict week to week how she'll, when she'll work, what hours she'll work. She finds out Saturday for the rest of the week. And for a 19-year-old with very little commitment, that's fine, right? She might miss a party or beach day with friends. But it's for someone who has children, someone who needs to plan childcare, someone who has elder care responsibilities, someone who even just wants to be part of their community, to your point about the loneliness epidemic, right?
Yeah.
Wants to take a class, wants to be part of an organization that helps out in their neighborhood. Like, you can't, it's so, and that's just one minor piece of the way in which we create these organizations that are not friendly to anything other than being an employee.
No, that's right. That's right. So let's kind of shift into individuals and from individuals to teams. Because I know pre-show we were talking about specifically like how more conflict, not less, helps for teams. But AI is creating this moment of like separation, pulling team members apart. So where do you see there to be opportunities for us to get people together to explore the work we're doing and find the conflict points when we just seem to be all going off into this like super individual contributor mode right now?
Yeah. Well, this terrifies me, I'll be honest. And not that I'm like an AI skeptic, but I worry, given the work I do and around collaboration, connection, humanity, emotions at work, I feel like so many of these tools are designed to eliminate those things, eliminate the need to collaborate with other humans. They eliminate the need to actually talk to other humans. And not only not talk to them, you don't have to be polite. I mean, when your coworker is someone who will, and I even hesitate to use someone, when your coworker is something that if it says the wrong thing, you just reprogram it. You can shut it down in the middle of a conversation when there's no need at all to be civil to it, that has to bleed over into our interactions with other humans. But whether that's colleagues or, to your point, the people we send people home to, right?
Yeah.
Is that we anthropomorphize these machines and these agents, and then we allow people to mistreat them because there's no requirement. Yeah. And then we expect them to somehow translate. I mean, I even have gotten into the habit of when I sit down to work with AI, tell myself, this is a machine. Like, I have to tell myself that.
Yes.
So that when I interact with my human colleagues, I treat them differently. And it's, I just worry that we're going to lose these skills not just to be polite and civil and to engage in difficult conversations, but we're going to just lose the tolerance for what is human foibles and messiness. And I worry that the people who are designing these tools see that as a feature, not a bug. And, yeah. And that really concerns me.
It's super concerning. Like, we had Zach Mercurio on the show just a few weeks back, and he was talking about his book, The Power of Mattering, and how we've seen this human skills decay over the last 20 years, heavily technology driven. You know, someone's going through a tough moment and all you need to do is send them a, you know, tears emoji and you've engaged with them, which isn't real, right?
Right.
But what you're saying here actually scares me more, because yes, there's been skills decay, but that's been on, I would say, the edges of how we're showing up in life. But this is starting to become core. If we're spending 7, 8, 10 hours a day in work and we're not connecting as humans, we're connecting with agents and machines, AI, that skills decay is going to start compounding. We're not going to start turning the ship anytime soon, which is a real worry. And I've even seen it personally. Like, I'm like, I just want to get back to working with AI because I can flood it with a whole bunch of ideas. I don't have to bring everyone up to speed and wait for other people's processing times to be different from mine. And I'm rolling. But then I run into this headlong problem, which is once I've developed something, I don't know how to bring it back to a customer or a teammate or a vendor, because I've gone too far and I'm now out on this island and I'm isolated. So that's an emerging and recent theme for me or experience, but I can only imagine if I'm there, a lot of others are too.
Yeah. And I mean, there are two things I want to say. One, there's interesting research that came out recently that shows that the number of words the average person speaks between 2005 and 2019 decreased. I think it's like 320 words a day.
Wow.
And you can imagine for some, it's probably not that we're interacting less. It's just digital. So we're actually just not speaking the words out loud.
Yeah.
But it does mean we're not speaking the words out loud. And it's in that speaking, it's in that mirroring someone else's behavior, listening for their words, watching their body language, misunderstanding, checking your understanding, you know, making a misstep, apologizing for the misstep, all of that happens in that verbal communication that we're missing out on. And and I think forms the basis for emotional intelligence. So that really worries me that we're speaking less. And it's like, to me, it makes me want to just walk around and talk to everyone all day to help bring the average words we speak up. And 320 words is not that great a number of words, but if you put it, that's a per day. So if you put that over, I think the researchers said, if you put it over a year, it's like basically like reading Pride and Prejudice out loud.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Sense and Sensibility, but it's significant number. Right. So that really worries me. And then I think it'll become, we're not just hearing people's voices, but we're missing out on all that mirror neurons. And, you know, I also think I had this experience recently with an agent that I've built. I don't like to call it Claude because I don't like the anthropomorphizing. I just call it Anthropic. But that an agent I've built in Anthropic that I find often misunderstands me. And like, I'll ask it to do something. I'm like, oh, no, that's not quite right. And then I give it the feedback. And it's so sycophantic that it's like immediately like, oh, no, you're right. Like, fix this, you know. And I find it's such a unpleasant interaction. And in some ways, I probably should find it an easier interaction, because if I was dealing with someone who misunderstood me in person, that a human who misunderstood me that much, I would be, you know, it would be so messy and complex and they wouldn't fix it as quickly. But I find it so like deadening to my soul, because if you and I are interacting and I'm like, Dane, you know what, you're not quite getting what I'm saying. Hold on. There's a moment of delight in it. right? Of like, because we, when we get to the moment where you do understand me, or I've rearticulated in a way you understand, or we realize we're never going to understand each other.
Yeah.
It's this connection. I don't have that at all with this agent. And I find it, and it's doing the things that it's supposed to do, right? It's apologizing, it's fixing it, it's getting a better draft, it's doing whatever it's doing, but it just feels so flat to me.
It is flat. It's really flat. I wonder then, I was talking to Jacob Taylor the other day. He's up at the Brookings Institution, and he just wrote a paper on vibe teaming. And so I wonder whether then, you know, when you put some of these concepts that we've discussed today together, if you can bring people together in a room with pens and paper, not with AI, and actually get back to like having conversation. I wonder if as teams, we need to be like creating those moments very intentionally. And then you can take away context to feed into AI and bring things back. But it's almost like we need to be rethinking the rhythm of our teams and businesses and actively avoiding this hyper-individualization, hyper-specialization, which is starting to happen.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how long ago it was, there was always this like digital detox, like advice, like, oh, you get off your screens for the, do this. And I always liked that it was like for an hour, and now it's like for 2 months, now it's like forever. But I do think what you're prescribing is sort of a digital detox for collaboration. And I've seen it. I was having a meeting with someone yesterday where neither of us asked this to happen, which maybe shows how tech savvy, untech savvy I am. But we both showed up to this meeting and in a Zoom call, and we both had bots there on our behalf to take notes. And I was like, did you ask yours to? I didn't ask mine to come. And we're like trying to figure out how to turn them off. And then she was telling me about a time where she showed up and there were more bots in the room than there were humans. Yes. And it happens without you asking it to do it now, which is terrifying. I know I keep using that word, but it's a good adjective for my emotions lately. But that to me is like, what if we just had bot-free meetings? What if we had like, what's the least amount of technology? To your point, pen and paper. What's the least amount of technology we can bring to this meeting, and how does it change it? I'm fascinated by there's been a lot of studies about phones in schools.
Yes.
And I heard this great BBC story about this British school that eliminated phones, and the teachers talked about how it changed the culture of the school.
Yeah.
And things like they had to teach entirely differently because they weren't refocusing kids all the time.
Of course.
Right? So things that you would expect. But then they also said, like, this made me so happy. They said, we saw kids flirting because all of this romance stuff was happening via the phone. So now they're now actually flirting in person. And I thought, okay, what do we miss? What's the equivalent of flirting in the workplace? Not that we want people flirting in the workplace, but what's the equivalent of that fun sort of banter and connection and that we've totally lost?
I don't know what it is, but I think that's a worthy mission to go on and find.
Yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't it be fun? And for teams to just like, we're going to have, and the temptation would be like, we're going to do an offsite, but I would like, no, can you go through half your day with no technology or with very limited technology, or, you know, what are the ways we can turn it down and just see what happens?
Because I think right now. Together. Specific.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Think. Fight. Debate. Brainstorm. All like what happened. Yeah.
I'd love to see that, Andy. I'm excited for that, because if you weave those things into the work, then essentially you're turning the world and your work into a classroom. But it's more than the classroom, because it's like there's connection there too. So we're not just learning, we're learning and connecting, which I think is a really worthy cause for most leaders to be driving in their teams and in their businesses.
Oh, well, and I wish I haven't heard a leader do, well, I'm trying to think if I've heard a leader do this. I haven't actually. They've gotten close, but there's to say, one of the skills that we're going to need in the age of AI, every article, it's emotional intelligence. we don't build emotional intelligence when we interact with machines. So if we do this sort of digital detox or turning down the technology use, like, we are building the skills we all need, right? Like,
yeah.
Let's do it not because it's an interesting experiment, but let's do it to intentionally build our emotional intelligence skills.
I love that.
Because we need that.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking of tons of ideas. I want to actually come back. I know we've run up on time today. It's been a great conversation from the origin point of like being intrigued by why people say one thing and mean another. Moving into the fact that businesses have always said it's business, it's not personal, but it's always personal. You can't check the emotions, the ego at the door. And so that framing is huge. And I loved how we moved into the regardless of culture, whether they're overly polite or overly command and control, the ways to go and find the conflict and to ask the questions and to get teams bringing things up are super important. Coming to this final piece, I'd love to find a way to reconnect here over the months and see where there's some good sort of edge cases of where people are bringing the digital detox or they get the teams in a room together, whether it's to do work or to cook or do something that's in the work but isn't the work. It'll be cool to find that.
I'd love that. I'd love that. And we didn't even get into my second book, Getting Along, because there's like all the stuff around difficult people. Maybe we need to have another conversation.
I think we need to do a second show for sure, okay. And particularly one with less of my technical challenges this particular Friday.
Hey, that's part of it. Like, yeah, this is the fun, right? Like, we navigated it together. I'm like, yeah, I love Dane. He knows how to roll with the punches. Like, this is great. So this is all, and I absolutely am up for a part two whenever you'd like.
We'll lock it in soon because I think this is a really important moment. And you used the word terrifying a number of times today, and I'm equally terrified. I think we've got to get on top of this and soon because otherwise our adolescent selves working with AI or maybe the AI's adolescent are going to build some pretty gnarly adult tendencies that are going to be hard to reprogram. Right.
A very, very good point. Yeah. Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
Thanks, Amy. And for any of our listeners that want to find the books or your work, where do they best connect with you?
Yeah, my website's the easiest place, amyegallo.com. And you can find my books there. You can sign up for my newsletter. LinkedIn is also, I post a lot of content on LinkedIn as well. So you can follow me there and connect there as well.
Awesome. We'll be back together soon for episode number 2.
Look forward to it.
Thanks, Amy. See ya.
All right. Bye.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.